good horse, I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And this we go riding.
You're listening to episode 529 of Unwelcome Guests. Unite and Conquer, Part 1. I'm Robin Upton. This week on the show, a range of material. Our first speaker, Paul Bloom, is new to the show, and he's presenting some quite tidily defined academic research. Our second speaker, Brian Wilson, a peace activist, is actually a rebroadcast from episode 166. We're just going to have the conclusion of his speech because it fits well into the general theme of the show. We're going to close with another speaker we've had before, Elizabeth Sotouris, a much wider, open-ended talk about consciousness and creation, re-envisioning what is humanity, why are we here, looking at deeper issues. Now, let's get straight on with Paul Bloom, a psychology professor from Yale University, and he's speaking from earlier this year.
What I want to do today is talk about some ideas I've been having about human kindness, human niceness. And I'll begin with a story that Sarah Hurdy tells at the beginning of her recent, very nice book, Mothers and Others. So she describes herself on an airplane, and it's a crowded airplane. She's flying coach. She's waiting in line to get to her seat. People are pushing and shoving. Food's going around, but she's not the first person to be served. She's watching other people being served. And there's a crying baby. And the mother's soothing the baby. Person next to the baby's trying not to look annoyed. People are cuckooing the baby. And as she points out, this is entirely unexceptional. Billions of people fly each year. And this is kind of typical scene on a plane. But she imagines for a moment what would happen if every individual on a plane was transformed into a chimp. She points out that chaos would reign. When the time the plane landed, there'd be body parts all over the aisles, and the baby would be very lucky to make it out alive. People are nicer than chimps. Human niceness shows up in all sorts of ways. We give to charity. Americans give hundreds of billions of dollars each year to charity. And you could be cynical about some of that giving, but some of the giving seems to be genuinely motivated by care for others. We leave tips at restaurants. We leave tips in our hotel rooms. Some of us, when leaving this hotel, will leave money for the maid, even though this has no possible gain to ourselves, not even a reputational gain. It will make no difference in our lives. But we feel that we should, and we do so. My favorite experiment on adult human niceness was done by Stanley Milgram many years ago. Stanley Milgram's the Yale psychologist who's famous for his obedience experiments at Yale, where he gets people to believe that they killed each other. But this is an experiment on niceness. What he did was, in New Haven in New York City, is he left envelopes all around, stamped envelopes, all around the city, on ledges, on the ground, which were stamped and had his name and address on it. A very simple, elegant experiment. How many would come back to him? And the answer was about 80%. 80% of them, people picked up, they saw, they put it in a mailbox, and they mailed it. It wasn't indiscriminate. So if instead of Stanley Milgram on the address, it was Friends of the Nazi Party, people wouldn't deliver it. Presumably they'd walk over, they'd throw it in the garbage, they'd say, hell with that. But they would deliver it. In a more recent study, somebody did the same thing, didn't even put stamps on them. About 1 in 5 came back. About 1 in 5 people picked it up, said, oh, I guess someone dropped this. I'll get a stamp, put a stamp on it, dropped it in a mailbox. They're extraordinarily nice. I'm a developmental psychologist, and I'm interested in where this niceness comes from, in the origin of human niceness, the origin of human kindness. And it turns out, and I think this is a really cool discovery over the last many years, including some very recent work over the last 5 years, and ongoing work, that an extraordinary amount of this niceness seems to be hardwired. And part of the motivation for this work, or at least the idea was anticipated by Adam Smith hundreds of years ago. And Adam Smith is the founder of modern economics, but he was very sophisticated when it came to human kindness and human sentiment. And he pointed out that when you see somebody in pain, you feel the pain as if it was yours. And you're motivated to make it go away. You're motivated to help. And this is a primitive good that doesn't reduce to any other good. And it turns out that this is true even for babies. When babies hear crying, they'll start to cry themselves. And some very cynical psychologists said that's because babies are so stupid. They hear a baby cry, they think they're crying, so they get upset and they cry some more. But it turns out even more clever psychologists did experiments where they exposed babies to tape-recorded sounds of their own cries and tape-recorded sounds of other babies' cries, and find that they cry more to the sounds of other babies than to their own cries, suggesting it's somehow outer-directed. When a baby sees somebody in trouble, another baby in pain, even silent pain, the baby will grow distressed. And as soon as the baby is old enough to move around his or her body, they'll try to make the pain go away. They'll stroke another baby. They'll try to hand over a toy or a bottle. In some recent work that Roy mentioned in passing, by Felix Varnikin and Michael Tomasello, they created a very clever experiment of toddlers where they put a toddler in a situation where nobody is looking at the toddler, nobody is making any demands upon the toddler, and an adult comes in, and an adult has some sort of minor crisis, like is reaching for something and can't get to it, or is trying to get into a cabinet with his arms full. And they find that toddlers, more often than not, will spontaneously toddle over and try to help. And again, this is a sign of the origin of human niceness that's manifest in behavior, and I think it just really tells us something important about ourselves. In my own research, I've been interested not so much in moral action, not so much in altruistic behavior, but in moral cognition, moral intelligence. And this is a series of studies that I've been doing in collaboration with Cameron Wynn, my colleague at Yale, and who runs the Yale Infant Lab, and a wonderful graduate student of ours, Kylie Hamlin, who's now an assistant professor at University of British Columbia. And what we did was we basically created a set of one-act morality plays where there's a character, and then there's a good guy, and there's a bad guy. So for one of them, there'd be a character he's trying to make, and the character would often be an animated figure or a simple geometrical figure or sometimes a puppet. And so, for instance, for one of our studies, a character would be struggling to get up a hill. One guy would come and push him up. Another guy would come and push him down. For another one, a character would be playing with a ball, would roll the ball to another puppet. They'd look at each other. And then in one condition, the puppet would roll it back. Or, playing with a ball, roll a ball to another puppet, they'd look at each other, then the puppet runs away with the ball. In a third one-act play, there's a puppet trying to open up a box, a transparent box. You see there's a toy in there. And one puppet comes and goes in and opens the box. Another condition, trying to open up a box, and one puppet comes and jumps on the box. And then, now if you have these three, these are three examples, we have a couple more in the works now. And what we find is they all have a good guy and a bad guy. And what we find is that if you ask toddlers, if you ask kids around 19 months of age, just who's the good guy? Who's the bad guy? They respond virtually always in the way you expect for adults. They point to the proactive, the person who helps the character achieve his goals for the good guy. They point to the disruptor, the thwarter as the bad guy. That's not so exciting, 19-month-olds. But what we've done is we've pushed it lower and lower. So what we do is, in one set of studies, we hold out both characters. And we ask that we see where the baby will reach for, where the baby will choose. And just as an experimental minutia, everything is counterbalanced, and the person who's offering the choice is always blind to what the movie was. So there could be no cueing possible. And the parents have their eyes closed during the study, because the baby's often on a parent's lap. And then what we find is, down to 6 months of age, they'll reach for the good guy. And we also have neutral conditions. So we find that they'd rather reach for the good guy than to a neutral guy, but they'd rather reach for a neutral guy than to a bad guy, suggesting that there's two forces behind the difference. One is they like the good guy, the other one is they don't like the bad guy. In a recent study, which is in press in developmental science or developmental psychology, some journal, maybe both, that could be not the first time it's happened to me. We test three-month-olds. Now, three-month-olds are blobs. Three-month-olds are meatloafs. They can't move their arms well enough to reach. But we know from the six-month-old study that before babies reach, they look to where they're going to reach. So we do for three-month-olds, we see where they look. As predicted, they look for all of these scenarios to the good guy, not to the bad guy. Now, what this shows, does this show morality, a moral instinct? No. What it shows is they're sensitive to third-party interactions of a positive and negative nature, and they have preferences and later on labeling of these actions. And I think that that is relevant to morality. I think it's a useful moral foundation. How moral is it? Do they apply moral judgments? And the honest answer is we don't know. And this is something which we're excited in exploring, but as you could imagine, when you're dealing with six-month-olds, it's difficult to study. But we are embarking on some experiments addressing the moral question. So for instance, one aspect of mature morality is that you not only approach a good guy, you not only avoid a bad guy, but a good guy should be rewarded if there's rewarding going on. A bad guy should be punished. So with older toddlers, 19-month-olds, we do that experiment. So we have a good guy and a bad guy, and we give them treats. And what we find is they give the treats to the good guy. We also have a punishment condition. So we say to the kid, you have to take one of these from one of these. There has to be one. Take it from either one. They'll tend to take it from the bad guy. In an experiment we recently completed with 9-month-olds, with the graduate student Neha Mahajan, we did a study looking at their notions of justice. And to do this, we have a two-act play. So in the first act, you have a good guy and a bad guy. And they do their good guy, bad guy things from that list I gave you before. In the second act, what happens is two more characters come in. In one condition, one of the characters rewards the good guy, and the other character punishes the good guy. And we find that babies prefer by reaching the character who rewarded the good guy. Now, this is not so surprising, because we had the previous finding that babies like positive actors. So this could just be the same thing. The second condition is more interesting. You have the good guy and the bad guy. A character comes in and rewards the bad guy. Another character comes in and punishes the bad guy. Their babies robustly prefer the one who punishes the bad guy, suggesting that they will favor bad guys when they are being bad to those who are themselves bad. Suggesting some rudimentary, I'm happy to put in square quotes, but rudimentary sense of justice that perhaps could provide the foundation for later moral cognition. So these studies, and there are other studies looking at baby morality from René Bayarjon's lab at Illinois, or Luca Surian's lab in Italy, showing that there's some surprisingly precocious understanding of moral notions, surprisingly precocious propensity for moral action. And some people take these data and say, well, I could stop my talk now because I've solved the problem I've set out to answer. The origin of human niceness that we find is found in babies, that it is part of our hardwired inheritance. We are, you know, in Dacher Keltner's words, born to be good, and that we have what you can call a pure altruism. We are basically kind in general. And to the extent you find a narrowing of this kindness, a cruelty in adults, that's due to the corrupting forces of culture and society. This is not the argument I wish to make. I find the argument on theoretical grounds extremely implausible. For one thing, our brains have evolved through natural selection. And that means that the force that drives our psyche is differential reproductive success. And that suggests that our mind should be sensitive to factors such as kin selection and reciprocal altruism. We should be biased in favor of those who share our genes at the expense of those who don't. And we should be biased in favor of those who we are in continued interaction with at the expense of those who we are not. That doesn't mean pure altruism's off the table. Maybe some crazy things happen. Maybe, you know, you can't predict on a priori grounds how the mind will always work out. But it turns out there's now, I think, a substantial amount of developmental evidence suggesting that this kindness that we see early on is parochial. It is narrow. It is narrow to those that a baby is in immediate contact with and does not extend more generally until quite late in development, if at all. Here's some sources of evidence I'm thinking about. We've known for a long time that babies are biased towards the familiar when it comes to individuals. A baby will prefer to look at her mother's face than the face of a stranger. A baby will prefer to listen to her mother's voice as opposed to the voice of a stranger. But this bias also extends to categories. Babies prefer to listen to their native language rather than to a language that's different from theirs. Babies who are raised in white households prefer to look at white people, 3-month-olds. Than at black people. Babies who are raised in black households prefer to look at black people and not white people. We know that this isn't because the baby knows that they themselves are white or black, because babies that are raised in multi-ethnic environments show no preference. They're okay. They don't discriminate on the basis of color. As soon as they get older, about age 1, age 2, this bias in looking time, this bias in visual preference translates into a bias in behavior. They prefer to imitate those who look like them and those who speak the same language as them. Those who they discriminate against in terms of choice, in terms of behavior, against those who have an accent. They tend to be biased towards those in favor, relevantly similar to themselves. Around the age of 9 months, they'll show a stranger anxiety, which is the most, you know, sort of tangible evidence. They're terrified of strangers. They like to be with those familiar, and as soon as they're mobile enough, they try to avoid strangers. Strangers induce panic in them. There are some studies now with preschool children, older children, adolescents, finding that factoring away factors of similarity that the babies and children have been grown up with, it is trivially easy to get them to categorize and favor their own group over others, even when the group is established in the most minimal and arbitrary circumstances. And this is all based on Tajfel's work on minimal groups. So the standard experiments by Bigler and others, you take a bunch of children, say 7-year-olds, and you say, okay, kids, I have some red t-shirts and blue t-shirts. I'm going to just give them you guys to you at random. And they put on the t-shirts. You have the red t-shirt group and the blue t-shirt group. Now you ask a kid from the red t-shirt group, you say, I have some candy to give out. And you can't get any, but I'm asking how you give it to other people. Who do you want to give it to? You want to give it to everybody equally? Or you want to give it more to the red or more to the blue? You find biases. They are biased to give more to their own group, even when it doesn't include themselves into other groups. When asked about the properties of their group, who's nice, who's mean, who's smart, who's stupid, a kid who just put on a red t-shirt will favor the red t-shirt group over the blue t-shirt group. The final sort of bad news part of this talk comes from economic games. So many of you are familiar, this was mentioned in a previous talk, the ultimatum game. And there's all these games thought up by behavioral economists that purport to show niceness among adults, that we are generous in certain ways. I am highly skeptical about what these games really show, and we could talk about that if people want to pursue that in the question period. But what's interesting for these purposes is that children behave somewhat differently from adults in these games. I'll give you one example. Here's the dictator game. The dictator game is actually even simpler than the ultimatum game. The dictator game is, I say, I choose you and you at random. And I tell you, you guys have been chosen at random. Now, you're a lucky one. I'm going to give you $100. You can give him as much of the $100 as you want, everything from nothing to all of it. And he will never know. He will never know it's you. You will never meet again. It's anonymous. And what you find is people actually give. People give roughly $30, depending on the circuit, roughly 30%. Some people give nothing, some people give half, some people give more than half. But Ernst Fehr and his colleagues recently did this with kids. And what they did was they gave a very simple ultimatum game. They gave children two candies. And I don't know what the candies are, because it's Swiss. But it's, imagine Skittles. And I don't know if they have Skittles there, but they have Skittles. Two bags of Skittles. And you say to the kid, look, you've been chosen, you explain to them, and then you have a choice. You can either keep both bags of Skittles, or you can give one of them to this stranger, and now it's sort of even. It's equitable. 8-year-olds will often choose to do a split. Kids below 8, they always keep both Skittles. The numbers are like, those who give it away are like 10%. And when you get numbers that low, it's probably the kid got confused and pointed to the wrong thing. So if to the extent there's generosity in this game, it suggests it emerges late, at around age 8 or later. The situation is actually worse than this, because they did another study. Now there, for that sort of game, you're pitting against two impulses, right? You're pitting against, if the kid might have an equity, kindness, fairness impulse, but the kid also likes Skittles. So there's a desire to get a Skittle. You're pitting them against each other. So they did another study. Here they said, you've got two options. Either you get a bag of Skittles, and they get a bag of Skittles, or you get a bag of Skittles, and they get nothing. Now, from a consequentialist point of view, this is not a head-scratcher. There's no two competing impulses. Up until the age of 8, kids are perfectly indifferent. The number's about 50%. They don't care. Who cares whether or not he gets Skittles? I have nothing. To put a nice face on it, it's not like they hate the other anonymous person who wanted to deprive him of Skittles, but they have no interest in making sure he has them. I'll just raise as a more general perspective, taking away from the development evolutionary concerns. The history of humanity, from modern times all the way down to, as best we understand, hunter-gatherer groups, has been to view strangers, view non-relatives, view people in other tribes with hatred, fear, and disgust. Jared Diamond talks about the groups in Papua New Guinea that he encountered. And he points out, to go from one tribe and just kind of walk into another strange tribe would be tantamount to suicide. Other people have observed, Larry Hirschfeld and others have observed, that the languages that human groups use to describe themselves and others reflect this sort of emotional feeling. So groups tend to have a word for themselves, which often means something like person or human. Then they have a word for other people. And now sometimes this is just others, like in Lost. They call that other group the others. But sometimes they describe the other group the same word they use for huntable prey or food. And, you know, you don't see much love there. So that's a puzzle, then. Because you take the niceness we see now in the world today, by at least some people in the world, some of us who behave very differently, and you find that the state of nature, our evolved capacity, is quite a bit less nice. And so the question is, how do we end up bridging the gap? How have we gotten so much nicer? And I'm focusing here on questions of our kindness to strangers, but this question could be asked about all sorts of things, like new moral ideals, like that slavery is wrong, or that we shouldn't be sexist, or we shouldn't be racist. These are deep puzzles. And what I want to do is, and a lot of really smart people have approached this, I want to just give two compatible candidate answers for how we've gotten nicer. The first is interdependence, increased interdependence. And this is something that Robert Wright has been arguing in a series of books, and Peter Singer and Steven Pinker have also argued it in different forms, which is that as you connect with more and more people in a relationship where there is interdependence, where your life is improved by being able to connect with the other person, a non-zero-sum relationship, you become, through in an enlightened, selfish way, you care about their fates. Robert Wright has a tremendously politically incorrect summary of this. He once said in a talk, "One of the reasons I don't want to bomb the Japanese is that they built my minivan." And then the idea is that because he's in a commercial relationship with these people, his compassion gets extended where they wouldn't have otherwise been. Now, this is a speculation, but there's a little bit of support for this. And this support comes from a study by Joe Henrich and his colleagues that was published in Science a few months ago. And what Henrich and his colleagues did as part of a very large study they've been pursuing over the last decade was they looked at 15 societies, including our society and others similar to ours, but also societies that were very different. And they had the people in these societies play a series of these economic games, versions of the dictator game, the ultimatum game, various public good games. And they found certain things. They found, for instance, that there's huge variation in how nice people are to anonymous strangers. And put aside the question how nice people are to their kin, which I think is going to be a very different story, but people are very different in how nice they are to anonymous strangers. But then they did some analyses as to what determines how nice people are in these games, and they found two answers that are actually fairly surprising. One answer is capitalism makes people nicer. That is, immersion in a market economy has a strongly significant relationship with how nice we are to anonymous strangers, presumably for the not-so-surprising reason that if you're in a market economy, you're used to dealing with other people in long-term relationships, even if they're not your family and they're not your friends. The second factor, which was weaker but significant, was membership in a world religion. And the world religions in that case were Christianity and Islam. And Henrich et al. Argue that this is because it immerses people into a larger group, larger than they would otherwise find themselves in, and again, in some way entrains them to deal with strangers. That's half the story. A second half is, and I'm more interested in this as a psychologist and as a developmental psychologist, is the power of stories. There is now abundant demonstrations that when you see an individual, you see the person's face, you hear the person's name, and Sam referenced some of this work, it draws your empathy towards them far more than a list of numbers or statistics or a mere verbal description. And this is to a large extent because I think it actually sort of, to some extent, fools the system into believing this is a person in your proximity. This is your kin. This is your friend. And so one of the consequences of fiction and of journalism is that they could bring distant people closer to you. And we now know that could expand one's sympathies towards individuals, but I think it also expands one's sympathy towards groups. So Martha Nussbaum and many others have argued that by being able to encounter, as if they were in front of you, people from very disparate lifestyles, you then see them in a different way. It triggers the same cognitive mechanisms you would get for those who are honest to God close to you, and you get nicer. I think, as a case in contemporary United States, that one of the great moral changes in our society over the last 50, 100 years has been the treatment of whites and attitudes of whites towards African Americans. One of the great changes in the last 10 years has been the changes of straight people's attitudes towards gay people. I think for both cases, the force for moral change was not philosophical argument or theological pronouncements or legal debates. It was fiction. In particular, I think one of the great forces of moral change in our time is the American sitcom. I'll end by saying that this speaks to one of the issues that I think occupies many people in this room, which is the role of rational deliberation in morality. And I think in some way, I am not by far the first to make this argument, that there's on the face of this a contradiction, almost a paradox, which is on the one hand, social psychologists have a million demonstrations that people are impervious to rational argument. The reason why I come to my views about slavery or gay people or whatever is most frequently not because somebody gives me a real persuasive argument. Rather, I'm manipulated by images, by prototypes, by exemplars, by all sorts of gut-level, intuitive, emotional factors. But at the same time, we know full well that, I know full well, that rational thought has made a difference in the world. That people's deliberations, as a recent example, Peter Singer's thoughts on issues such as how to treat non-human animals, have changed the world. And I think one way out of this, and this is very similar to something John has argued, is that reasons do affect us, but they affect us indirectly through the medium of emotions. And this is a research project in psychology of tremendous importance that very few people are studying, which is how do people come up with new moral ideas, and how do people do the tremendous task of translating these moral ideas into ways that persuade others. I've made three arguments here. One is that humans are, in a very interesting way, nice. A second is that we have evolved a moral sense, and this moral sense is powerful and can explain much of our niceness. It is far richer than many empiricists would have believed. But the third is that this moral sense is not enough. The accomplishments we see and we admire so much in our species are due to factors other than our evolutionary history. They're due to culture, our intelligence, and our imagination.
A rather self-congratulatory, certainly optimistic note on which to end that presentation. The niceness of our intelligence, culture, and imagination. Our concluding speaker this week is certainly going to stretch our imagination beyond the framework to which it is usually accustomed, just as that talk showed the lie to the need for culture to prevent the innate nastiness of human beings manifesting. I was very interested in the finding about capitalism. As somebody who's been a vocal proponent of altruistic economics for the last 5 years, and I've got to follow that up. While I was listening to that, I thought, yeah, perhaps capitalism does make people nicer in the way that he's measuring it, and yet society as a whole can get nastier. How would that be? Well, society is not an equal weighting of individuals' decisions. As we heard last week, for example, there's a place called the Bilderberg Group where 100 people who control a large proportion of the money in the world, whether through their own assets, their company's assets, or because they run the money system, and their vote is not accorded equal to yours or mine. Now, to return to the important subject of the psychopath, only about 1% of the normal human population is born without a conscience. So, in terms of significance, as measured by the individual studies, they're not likely to be detected. But if they can rise up to the top of large hierarchical organizations by virtue of their peculiar physiology, and then can dominate them ruthlessly, this could explain how, with most people still getting nicer, we could have, for example, corporations turning a blind eye to cancer because they know they can make more money treating it than if people didn't get it in the first place. We could see a lot of the self-destructive behavior that we have witnessed through many episodes of the show. And Paul Bloom talked about the need to see people and to identify with them, and it's my hope that as communications technology continues to improve, then more and more people will be able to see the consequences of the decisions which are being made, and their niceness will manifest in disobedience to a murderous corporate money-driven culture which is destroying the planet. And this is the angle that Brian Wilson, our second speaker, is taking. He was a soldier in Vietnam until he had his own personal epiphany, and suddenly asked himself, what am I here killing these people for? What have these people ever done to me? And subsequently has dedicated his life to being a peace campaigner. In this talk, he's speaking about Korea, and it's the conclusion that we're hearing now because it's relevant to all of us, especially those who are citizens of the developed world, whose acculturation is to think inside the box of acquisitiveness, selfishness, of separateness from others. And he's putting in an impassioned plea that we get out of the box, not to blame ourselves or to blame others for what is done, but to look forward to a future in which human culture regards all life as sacred and treats it as such.
I've traveled all over North Korea, as well as I have South Korea, and I've talked with hundreds, if not thousands, of people, always with a translator, of course. But you know, they're people just like us. They laugh, they cry, they want security, they want peace. They don't want to fear when they're going to be bombed again. During the Korean War, one-third of all the population in North Korea was killed. One of the highest percentages of deaths in the history of warfare. Everybody you meet in North Korea, everybody I've met in North Korea, everybody, without exception, lost one or a dozen or 20 family members, and they can start talking about who in their family died in the bombings. It's a scar that hasn't been healed, and we've continued to demonize North Korea for various reasons, partly to maintain our justification for Star Wars, because Korea has missiles, we say, that can maybe hit the Aleutian Islands, part of the United States. We want to make sure that China continues to be surrounded. Even though we want their markets, we also fear China. We're all fourth of the world's population. It certainly helps justify continued escalated Pentagon budgets to have these enemies, Cuba, 90 miles off our shore, this big threat to us, 11 million people. Can you imagine that if the human species survives, archaeologists and anthropologists will be wondering, what on earth were these people thinking? What on earth were they doing? How could they have been so deranged as to have all these weapons of mass destruction, all this social decay, inattention to details of the well-being of its own citizenry, while it's planning to control space? It's since 1997 has this concept of full spectrum dominance. We want to dominate every spectrum of life. Wow, what an obsession we have. It's kind of like a mental illness. And I'm wondering when we as a people will, in either individually or collectively, in a fairly short period of time, recognize our need to the equivalent of a storming of the Bastille, a kind of an explosion of our humanity that decides to come out of the box. This box to me is really stifling. It's suffocating. And we're suffocating the planet. We're suffocating life itself with this obsession with commodities, protection of resources so that we can make more commodities. People so stressed out with credit card debt that they can't even pause to re-examine their life even for a couple of minutes because they're so busy trying to survive. And yet, what is the survival leading to? So I have this faith that we are able and capable of having an explosion of our consciousness, call it a quantum leap, if you will, as an alternative to the suicide of extinction, which seems reasonably a reasonable outcome if we continue doing business as usual now. I mean, it's kind of like a no-brainer, and yet how do you break the cycle? And I think that perhaps Bush is a cosmic gift in disguise. He makes it so easy, or he makes it easier, to detect problems with this model that we have. He has unmasked the language and calls us. He even says to the Iraqis who are shooting and killing U.S. soldiers, come on, kill us. I mean, he's the president, acting as president, urging people to shoot at U.S. soldiers. I mean, I just can't conceive of having this kind of person as commander-in-chief of the most powerful, the most imperial military in the world. It seems surreal to me. It seems almost unbelievable. But then again, we live in a make-believe society. And the question is, when will we decide? When will we choose to say, I must begin climbing out of the box because my humanity has been stifled long enough, and I know that my well-being, as I have defined it, has been dependent upon exploitation all over the planet, hurting many people. I lost 50 friends in Nicaragua to the Contras. I lost 15 friends in El Salvador to the death squads. You know, I get the calls. Jose was killed last night. And, you know, after a while, you wonder, if you're a clergy person, you might say, when is God going to balance the books? When is the accounting going to happen? When is the responsibility going to be felt in this culture? When are we going to become real? When are we going to actually decide that we have to revolt from a system that is so destructive that it's going to cause our own demise, our own demise? I believe that since it's such a critical issue in contemporary political terms, the issue of Korea, and that really most people in the West don't understand this history, this assault on the Korean psyche. And maybe people will recognize that there's a lot of pieces of history that have been assaultive that come back to us. And if we can start grasping the essence of what we've done in Korea, we certainly should have known what we did in Vietnam, although people still aren't willing to talk about the fact that we invaded Vietnam. We illegally intervened in Southeast Asia. It was not a noble war. It was a criminal war that killed 5 million people. And 400 interventions in our history, overt, at least 400. And maybe 10,000 covert interventions since 47. So I'm just hoping that one aspect of the revolutionary process is more awareness of this history and the patterns of this history that have led to a George Bush who can be so cocky to say we're now going to basically control the world and the world's resources, and whoever gets in our way, we'll blow them away. I mean, we've had that policy for a while, but it's never been laid out that explicitly, that openly. And if you love it, like some of my own relatives love, who drink beer and watch television and say, nuke them all. I think, boy, I went to church with these people. I went to school with these people. We had picnics together. How could we have such a different take on the world? Well, they've never left home. I left home at the age of 20. Is that what it takes? I mean, I just heard a statistic the other day that only 5% of the U.S. citizens have passports. Is that possibly true? That only 5% of the population have traveled to another country? I don't know. That was a statistic I saw. we're very insulated, we're very spoiled, we're in denial, and my hope is that we will have a desire, maybe it's a hope against hope, that we will have a desire as never before to find our humanity and to say to the world, we're sorry. We're sorry for all we've done to inflict this pain and this misery, and begin wailing, if you will, in tears. Because when you realize what you've done that has been so painful, you do cry, as I have cried many times in 34 years since I was in Vietnam, for having committed so much harm from so much ignorance, and to realize that my whole civilization is built on killing the indigenous, killing Africans, and then killing people all over the world that were in the way of our getting what we wanted on our terms. It's quite a history. It's not a sustainable history. It's not a sustainable model. And I'm interested myself in living in a sustainable world. So I'm hoping that all of us will recognize the need for our own quantum leap, our own revolution, if you will, of consciousness that will carry us with our imagination and with courage in places that we can't imagine at this moment, but that will liberate us from our own box. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a talk by Vietnam veteran and peace activist Brian Wilson. Thanks to the LA Sound Posse for that recording.
Many thanks to Brian Wilson for that beautiful and beautifully articulated conclusion. What would it take for that to be a standard world view? What would life be like in a world full of people who had understood the consequences of what has gone on? People who have seen behind the facade of the small number of fat, white decision makers who mask their psychopathic intent with carefully controlled, well-mannered, manicured language. As communication technology improves, it is that much easier for people, if they want to see the consequences of what is going on. Americans don't have to travel to Iraq to see the consequences of what is being done in their name in Iraq. Yes, they do need an imagination to get out of the box. They do need to see materialistic, reductionist, acquisitive corporate culture for the poison that it is. But understanding its deadly nature is that much easier if you've just come down with cancer, which, as we noted in episode 524, is having a huge rise, and there are companies with a direct financial interest in making that happen. The logic of a psychopath, that other people have only relevance in as much as they affect one's own selfish, separate well-being, is coming home to roost. What was done abroad is now done at home. If non-Americans can be held without trial and tortured, why not Americans? The claims to virtue of the psychopathic, technocratic elite appear to me, at least, to be becoming ever more tenuous. In such circumstances, self-interest combines with altruism to create what Brian Wilson calls a revolution in thinking, a determination not to go along with such a psychopathic system. Here is Elizabeth Soutouris speaking on consciousness and creation, reinterpreting deep stories of what is humanity, why are we here, how should we behave, and so on. I think this presentation is from 2009, and I've slightly trimmed it in order to fit the time. It goes on through our second hour.
The Western process of having dumped God and moving into individualism and now forming a new kind of community is a very important trajectory in the great human drama. In my universe, the basic principle is anything that can happen will happen. Somewhere, someplace, somehow, anything possible will happen. And therefore, somebody had to try out the game of pretending that we weren't part of the whole, and that rather we were gods in charge manipulating the whole thing. We had to learn where that leads us. Now we know. But we've learned a lot of good things about individuation that we can now weave into a new kind of community. So it was a very important, it wasn't a wrong way to go, because in the largest picture, nothing is wrong. It's all just wildly creative and trying things out, isn't it? Then there was a little bit of confusion for some people, I believe, about the concept of emptiness that Andrew talked about it. And I always liked the Greek word chaos, which, because chaos, as we now know from chaos theory, is really the fullness of potential. The old word plenum was better than emptiness, in a sense. And now that we understand the zero-point energy field, we know that even though this thing isn't tangible, isn't measurable easily, without very difficult scientific experiments to show it's there, that there's an infinite amount of energy at every point in our space-time universe. And why are we living in a space-time universe? I believe it's because it gives us the opportunity to unpack the creative process. The closest thing to the afterlife is your dream life. In your dream life, you think grandma, grandma's there. You think a table, table's there, right? It's just like that. You create instantly. And truly, deep down, creation is instantaneous. But in order to understand it, in order to recognize ourselves as co-creators in the universe, we had to unpack it by inventing a linear time frame where if you want a table, you have to acquire the wood and cut it into pieces and first of all make the plan of what a table is mentally and then carry it out a step at a time. This teaches us the creative process. So it's a very important part of our human, of our cosmic experience to do that. And another favorite book of mine is called Meetings with the Archangel by Michael someone? Anyone read it? There's a wonderful scene where the angel comes down and talks to the protagonist and says, "Don't look to us angels for compassion because we can't even feel passion. We don't have bodies. And we see that whatever it is you're going through is really hard. You writhe and twist and turn and all kinds of things happen in your lives that don't look too good from here. So we really admire you for taking on bodies and trying it out." And I'll talk a little bit more about that in my talk too. So now let me get on with my own show. Okay. Here we are, changing our personal and planetary destinies, as we all know. And I'm going to talk about nature's secrets of success as the keys to our own destiny. I early asked these big questions of who are we, where did we come from, where are we headed? And these trees in the background of this slide are the trees I actually played under at this age. And when I went to my 50th high school reunion, I was more excited about seeing my tree friends were still there than even my two-legged friends. It was just an amazing homecoming for me. I didn't know, of course, at the time that these were the great philosophical questions of the ages, and I later learned that the ancient Greeks had named science philos sophias, lover of wisdom, because they saw the purpose of natural science as learning from nature in order to find guidance in human affairs. And that is exactly the reason that I went into science myself. I somehow, even as a child, intuited that we had to know how everything works in order to know where we were headed. And then I found that science, which I chose to study because that was where these answers were supposed to be, didn't actually answer such questions at all. And I ended up feeling that I was doing trivia research while the world was burning, and left science and went to Greece, largely because I had met and stayed for a week with Henry Miller and was enamored of his book, The Colossus of Marousi, which is a wonderful book of philosophy, and was written about his trip to Greece on the eve of World War I. And his stories of Greece were truly wonderful. And that's largely why I went there. And I found in Greece, I think, nature's intelligence and my own spirit. And that was a very important time. I look back on it as my midlife retirement, and I think it was the most intelligent thing I probably ever thought up to do. I was 43, and my youngest had just graduated high school, and I was free. I did not expect to stay for 13 years, but I did. And then later, I also spent a year in the Peruvian Andes, because I had by that time gotten to co-found an indigenous science network and wanted to look into the ancient Peruvian sciences, which were spectacular. And I learned a lot from indigenous cultures, but it really was Greece that took me back to science, even if I found that I had to do it my way. When I went to Greece, I was going to write novels to explain the human condition to myself. I did write three novels, two of which I burned before I came back. The other is still in my filing cabinet. And and then I decided I still wanted to understand the universe in a scientific way, so I wrote the first version of Earth Dance there. Now, humans have always been storytelling creatures. And what we do with those stories is share our experience. You know, we're talking beings, talking out loud. The rest of nature is in communion while we are in communication. Not that we can't also do communion, but communication is our dominant mode in the current time of this planet. So we tell a lot of stories, religious stories, scientific stories, cultural stories, and then our realities reflect our stories and beliefs. And I have a hard time distinguishing between stories and beliefs, because most of the things that we call facts in science change over time. So it's a lot of fun to watch the changing stories of humanity. And every human culture has always had a kind of leading creation story that tells you how things are in your world and how to behave within your world. And they can be religious, they can be scientific, they can be any kind of cultural story that works. Now, the two greatest stories of Western science are the physics story, which is the story of a non-living universe running down by entropy. It's a bit depressing, that story, but it's been around for quite a while now. And then we have the biology story. Can that cheer us up? Not really, because it's about endless struggle and scarcity. Now, dear people, these are the two main elements in our creation story. I think it's probably the most depressing creation story in history of any culture. It's not alive with things being made, really. It's all accidental, and it's not working very well because it's running down. And, you know, there's one big bang, and it's all downhill from there. And I think this story needs updating, really, seriously. It's a story of us as mindless, mechanical, or that we live in a mindless mechanical universe, and that we are some kind of complex machinery that generates mind magically, kind of magically in that story. The clockwork universe models appealed to the early European scientists because they were being creators of machinery. So they project the machinery onto the cosmos, and Descartes tells us that God is the grand engineer inventing the machinery of nature, which includes man, and I say that deliberately here, not humanity, because women were robots like the other animals, but man had a piece of God mind enabling him to invent machinery. So projecting that kind of God clearly came out of the discovery of mechanics and maybe needs to be updated. I mean, these guys don't look very excited about life, do they? So and the funny thing is, you know, that Newton was actually an alchemist and into the Kabbalah and all things like that, but all that got squelched because science had to dump God. And nevertheless, the universal models became more and more elaborate, and then we modeled all our social institutions on machinery as well. And we expected them to run like well-oiled machines. So the whole Cold War was a contest between the Soviet East and the capitalist West about who had the perfect social machinery that was going to run well forever. But how well do machines really reflect our reality? Questionable now. That's it. Western science tells you that everything you touch, taste, and feel is what's real. In other words, if it's measurable, it's real. Now, oddly, Eastern science said what you touch, taste, and feel is not real. I think this is very interesting that the two leading sciences of humanity have come to these opposite conclusions about things. And isn't the internet wonderful with Photoshop and all the things? We are, you know, we're playing with realities. We're playing with realities because we're shifting from the ideas of a slow evolution, accidental evolution in a non-living, non-mechanical universe to one in which eventually we're going to see creation very, very differently through consciousness. Now, Webster's Online Dictionary, I was looking all over in different dictionaries for definitions of reality, and usually the first few are use the word real to define reality, which doesn't help to tell me reality is what's real. Okay? So you have to go and dig a little deeper, and you find finally in definition 4, it says, reality is non-derivative experience. This is big. Do you realize what it means? It means that only your first-hand experience is reality. And it immediately tells you that no two people can possibly have the same reality. So we have to learn to get along with each other with all our different divergent realities. And we have to figure out what's common to us all. What can we agree on in a world that's that shifting? And we heard about how we had tried cultural relativism and just said everybody's beliefs are equal and good, and we have to put up with them. And then we decided, no, there has to be some kind of standards for humanity, and perhaps they lie in values. This is a very, very interesting thing, though, that this actually stands in our dictionaries long before our culture believes it. Now, the culture of my adopted son in Peru, whose name is Puma, and that's him at age 15 on the right, and his grandfather in the middle on the left, his grandfather has been his teacher. Runakuna are the people we call the Quechua, and Puma is now a fully qualified medicine priest who has studied for 21 years at the age of 24 because he started at age 3 and he's just had his first baby. This is my newest grandchild. And this conscious being has been in touch with his father and grandfather or great-grandfather now since he was conceived. Isn't that an amazing baby? This baby is 1 week old.